Plato 2. He proceeded without introducing her to explain her role in his initiation, the objective of his visit to the academy. He spoke in abstruse legend, saying these things, that consciousness of the human, what may be called soul, was unbound before birth and winged, that by birth, by body, by habit, it became earthbound and lost its wings, or rather that the wings became bloodless, shriveled, shrunken, enfolded, drawn into the body, and no longer may bear us up and away. We are too laden with life. He paused when tea was brought to them quietly by the airy girl, and waited for each to be served, and sipped the first of it when its temperature was tolerable to his lips, before he began again. He explained how the rite of psychedelic passage regenerates the desiccated wings, brings them out of their sunken joints, and that it is painful. It is death in life.
You will never be the same.
The guide spoke softly, with slightly moving mouth, lisping lightly, smoothly as a metronome, in a tone uniformly which rises and falls from short breath to short breath, pausing for breath frequently, rising and falling rhythmically. His voice is self-absorbed. He speaks for eternity.
If you are not afraid of being a madman, if you would sacrifice yourself to your beloved, then gaze upon her, and then a shudder will pass, unusual heat and perspiration through you, as you receive the effluence of beauty through your eyes, your wings moisten and warm. And as they warm, the parts out of which the wing originally grew, which had become closed and rigid and had prevented them from shooting forth, these orifices shall melt. As nourishment streams upon you, the wing will swell and grow out from the root. The growth extend your whole soul, for once again you shall be winged. During this process, the whole of you is in a state of ebullition and effervescence, which may be compared to growing a limb from a stump where it was cut off. It thrusts out raw bone, raw flesh, open wounds, and has the feeling of anxiety, of dying, of wanting to die. But when in this manner the soul is beginning to grow wings, the beauty of the beloved meets your eye, and she receives the sensible, warm motion of your consciousness flowing towards her. into her, therefore called emotion. And she is refreshed and warmed by them, and then she ceases from her pain with joy.
The rock star is stunned. He sees nothing but blazing light.
Now, if she parts from you, her beloved, her moisture failing, then the orifices out of which your wings shoot will also dry up and close up and kill the germ of the wing, being shut up with the emotion, throbbing as with the pulsations of an artery. And then your soul is pierced and maddened and pained until, at the recollection of beauty of your beloved, is again delighted and refreshed. Do not hesitate then.
The guide's voice seemed giddy, almost tittering, like an excited schoolgirl rising.
This moment, this is the moment when it is in your grasp, when it is most painful, when most ecstatic. This is the most dangerous moment. You will be tempted to declare it, to claim. Do not try to take it. Let it go.
The guide clasped his forearm and shook it excitedly. Let it go. His eyes shone with gleams, and he spoke feverishly.
She shall unfold, and she shall fly.
He let go of his arm. His hand withdrawing trembled, and almost apologizing, he looked away almost in embarrassment.
Yes, yes,
nodding to himself.
And then, by and by, together oppressed in their strangeness, you have risen with her to a great strait, in great excitement, and in that great madness you cannot sleep at night, nor can you abide the day.
The guide lifted his face and was crying. He was truly and unreservedly crying tears.
But when the beloved meets the beloved, bathed in the waters of beauty, all constraint is loosened and both refreshed. No more pangs and pains. And this is the sweetest of all pleasures, and is the reason why your soul will never forsake your beautiful one, which it esteems above all. It has forgotten mother and brethren and life and being, and cares nothing of neglect and loss. Rules and proprieties on which you formerly prided yourself, you now despise. And you are ready to sleep like the homeless, wherever you are allowed, as near as you can to your desired one, the beloved, who is the object of your worship and the one physician who alone can assuage the greatness of your pain.
Tears of happiness shone upon the cheeks of the guide as he looked upon the seeker and smiled. He paused for a length of silence before he added, "I will leave you to become acquainted." They waited until they were certain he was gone. His noiseless departure made them uncertain they were alone. And so the seeker broke the ritual's sitting position and stood to look about the room. Seeing they were alone, the rock star spoke first. "What the fuck did that mean?" "It is his favorite formula," she replied, looking at him, smiling pleasantly. "My name is Suzanne." "My name is..." "I know who you are." "The unholy son of the Holy Mother, begot by the Father in this world, the unmentionable brother of the other." "I know who you are." "I doubt that you do." "I know." He shrugs. "So tell me, who is Suzanne? And why does she come here? And are you my beloved? Or what does that mean?" He lay on the floor and put his head to rest on his zafu, his arms crossed above him and his long hair. She turned where she sat to address him. "I thought you liked poetry. You should understand it as a poet. He speaks this way in poetic riddles sometimes. He is very educated, and he likes to make allusions to things that he has read. Do you understand it?" "I went to Sarah Lawrence. I studied with Joseph Campbell. None of this seems very strange to me." "Did you study poetry?" "I am a dancer. I only knew Campbell because of Jean, his wife. I studied dance with her. That is my main interest. And I am here because I am paid to be." "Not a true believer. Are you a true seeker?" He shrugged. She shrugged. "As he is dark and athletic, she is light and lithe. As he is ruddy and robust, if decadent and rude in appearance, she is delicate and willowy, pale. Her complexion was accented, however, by rich darkness, practically black hair, striking eyebrows, large, dark eyes, a skin so milky, yet she was tinged with rose highlights like a flush of sunburn. Her bare arms in short sleeves showed this sun on them too, while her bare tucked up legs below her shorts looked untouched by sunlight. Demure, he thought. An unlikely word to use for her, for she was supremely self-assured. She did what she wanted to do. She was not impressed by his presence or anything she knew about him. Likewise, she was not intending to impress others. That he did not need to explain himself or assume his persona made him feel comfortable with her. She saw the stains of turmeric powder on his pants legs, swaths from his fingertips. She said, "I should tell you that you cannot really know when he will do the initiation. He does not want you to anticipate. He wants you to be very calm. But he also wants you surprised." "I know," he said. "I don't think you do." "I understand, then. I am to be present, because I have been initiated, and because he thought I was the proper companion for you because I knew who you are, and he believes I see you objectively. Do you? I don't know you. Yes. That is as objective as I can be. She stood up and walked to the open French doors in the solarium, leaned to pull off her socks, and leaving them at the door, walked barefoot out onto the lawn and down the hill toward the lake. He stood up as she receded, went to the door, and watched her at the distance. When she reached the lake, she took off her clothes and dove naked into the lake. He returned to the kitchen to finish with his fenugreek. The evening meal was served on low tables after a meditation session, where the visitors and the residents sat upon the same zafus on which they had been meditating. It was customary for this meal to be very light, always vegetarian, of course. But tonight, the meal had several courses, beginning with a course of fresh fruit, and there was a guest, a distinguished Japanese Zen master, who read haiku and koans. In his honor, they served a fish course with the rice and vegetables, and served sake both before and after dinner, warmed in small ceramic carafes in the traditional manner. The guide gave another address, saying that while his subject was not Buddhist essentially, the ideas were certainly Oriental, that Pythagoras had learned the secrets of tribes beyond the edge of the world, who must have been the Brahman.
Consciousness does not know, but that it recalls. Thus, firstborn consciousness must recall things of previous existence. Now, most lose the memory of these things that once they knew. Very few retain adequate remembrance of them, and when they behold here any image of it, they are wrapped in amazement. But they are ignorant of what this rapture means, because they do not clearly perceive. They see through a glass darkly, and few behold the realities of them, and these only with great difficulty. There was a time, perhaps, when diligent practitioners beheld the beatific vision and were initiated into a mystery which may be truly called most blessed, celebrated by us in our state of innocence, before we had experience of evils to come. When we were admitted to the sight of apparitions, innocent and simple and calm and happy, which we beheld shining in pure light, pure ourselves and not yet enshrined in that living tomb which we carry about now, and that we are imprisoned in the body like the oyster in his shell.
The peroration ended. All politely awaited the guest's sagacious comment, to which, at last, the Zen master replied after a long, poignant silence, "Fish in water." And pausing for effect, he added, "How does the fish think what it does not drink?" Everyone laughed. The seeker, laughing with him, leaned over to whisper to his companion, "What the fuck does that mean?" She patted his leg. "Poor boy," she commiserated with him. "Drink more sake." Early in the following morning, he was greeted by her at his door, where he stood awakened from out of his bed, undressed. She saw that he had indeed the sort of penis for which he was famous, but said nothing about it, and told him to get dressed, that she would show him the tea house, where the initiation would occur. And she thought he would be better off if he was not surprised in any way. It was something she intuited about him. He invited her into the room. He said he had a new song. "Would you like to see it?" She sat on the end of the bed, and he sat beside her while she read the lyrics. There was no musical notation, but the lyrics contained a chorus. The chorus had evidently been written first, or rather, the first lines of the song had been written first, and then the portion that had become the chorus had been written. The page had been edited several times. It was a song about death. While she was reading, he took her idle hand and put it on his erection. He reached to the front of her blouse and unbuttoned it. She put down the sheet of paper and asked him, as he put his hand onto her bare breast, whether he knew the music before the lyrics or the lyrics before the music, and did he also compose the music. He fondled her and replied that sometimes he had music in mind and sometimes not. Often the music was created after the lyrics were written, often by the band, in collaboration with him. He said he sang. He did not play an instrument. He began to kiss her breasts. Still holding his erection, she said to him, "If I have sex with you, I cannot be your companion." He said nothing in reply. She added, "If I am not your companion, you must give up your initiation. There is no one else who will be permitted. He will send you away. You will lose your money." He lifted his head. He stood up, facing her. Looking at her exposed breast, he was tempted to take her mouth for his pleasure. He said instead, "I can't do that." She buttoned her blouse. He said, "I have come here and I need to finish this." She put her hands down to her lap. "Why?" she asked him. "Why is it so important?" He began to dress. He replied as he dressed, "I can't break through." He sat on the bed beside her, his tucked shirt unbuttoned, his hair tousled, leaning, his elbows on his knees. He looked at the floor. Do you understand? It is like I'm in a movie. Like there's some script, some voiceover talking about me, talking to me. I'm always watching myself. And I'm always aware that I am, but I can't stop it. Do you understand? Nothing is real to me. I do not feel alive. He looked at her as he said this. She stood, putting her hand out toward him. Let's go. He did not take her hand, but he drew on his shoes without his socks to follow her hurriedly. Outside, she asked him if he was hungry. He shook his head. The air was cool. It was a mountain's air, though these are not great peaks, but it was early in the day and autumn should soon come. The light was a lemon light. The birds sang for no reason. In such things he glimpsed what he wanted. She saw that and smiled at him. She wondered whether he will find what he wanted. She said to him, "You should go to Paris." "Why do you say that?" She did not reply. They walked across the lawn through a dewy grass that soaked their shoes and made their ankles wet and felt cold. At the lake, she led him to a path that circled it, taking him to the other side where the birch trees were illuminated by the sunrise that came from behind them, from behind the distant main house. They entered the woods, still following a clear path that descended the cool hillside, eclipsing the morning sunlight. In the hush of the trees, he said, "I have often thought of living in Paris. I want to write poetry there." "Yes, I know," she replied, and led him without further conversation through the woods, along the sometime broken trail, in a steep decline, down to the valley floor, to where they heard an occasional automobile passing on some asphalt highway somewhere near. When they stepped out of the woods, it was sudden, emerging from a break of sumac, which entirely obscured the highway. He stepped onto the asphalt behind her. A weedy meadow before them was divided by a dirt driveway, a buckshot fire number sign at the head of it, a weather-beaten bungalow at the end of it. A 1930s Ford coupe without glass in its windows or windshield, without tires on its wheels, is rusting in the trashy yard. A yellow dog lumbers off the broken-down stoop to bark at them, wagging its tail. She had turned on the side of the road and was walking away from him. They were shadowed below the hillside. "Where are we going?" he called after her. She only said, "It's not far." The road gradually curved round the hill, passing into the east, where the sun filled their faces, and they passed a ravine in which trickled a brook, perhaps from the lake above, which coursed beneath them through a corrugated culvert and emptied into a bog on the other side of the road. When they came around the third hill, the top of which he could see was cleared of trees, he heard the sound of a power saw from somewhere, and he heard an approaching vehicle behind them. The vehicle was picking up speed. The vehicle was playing a jingle, as played by a carillon echoing among the hills, the volume of sound increasing as it approached. The jingle was a repeating recording, getting louder and more distinct as it approached. It shimmered like a ersatz fairy music from a glass harp. The dance of the sugar plum fairy. And as in a dream, dizzily flushing his vision as a swirl of drowning waters, this memory blinded, then clarified, breaking through. The whirling merry-go-round, playing this carillon song or one like it, a wheel of mirrors rapidly spinning counterclockwise at its axis as he, on the rising and falling of his enameled horse, spun away the other way. Light bulbs of red and blue flashed staccato as the merry-go-round spun more madly, while blinking in the wheeling mirrors, his own self stuttered in frenetic reflection as the axis spun faster and faster, and the face of his mother blurred by on the air, like a smear of paint on the wind he felt on his fingers as he reached out for her, and he flew off the flying crystal ship, flung away into the air. They stopped. Both turned and listened, and watched as the vehicle, a pink ice cream truck, a giant plasticine clown head bobbling on a wildly wobbling giant spring on its rooftop, swept dangerously around the corner, going too fast for the curve, a pandemonium of hippies inside of it, fighting madly for control of the steering wheel. The music blared from the horn of a loudspeaker mounted on the roof before the wobbly clown. The driver saw the pedestrians in time to avoid them where they stood on the road, gawking at them as the truck careened past and screeched to a halt down the road, almost nose first into the opposite ditch. He said, "Did you see that?" The hippies slid open the driver's door and looked out from the ice cream truck, and one in white face, with a day-glow swell of buffoon starchy hair, a pink puff of cotton floss, leaned out from the ogling crowd and said, astonished, "Do you see that?" He could smell the pot and patchouli pouring out of the truck. Suzanne laughed and ran back to take his hand and told him to run away now. The ice cream truck backed up furiously as the gang of competing drivers steered it wildly backwards into the opposite shoulder of the road behind them and off the road and into the other ditch, while Suzanne drew him running up the hill into the woods, through brush, through bush, until they came to a clearing in sunlight. And breathless, she stopped and put her hand over his mouth and listened, smiling happily and whispering for him to be quiet. She whispered to him, "They recognized you." He nodded, and she withdrew her hand. The sound of the sugar plum fairy gradually crept away. She gestured at him, and he followed her. Thank you.
Thank you.